were two subjects that we had thought of asking Bob to speak about. He's spoken many times. One was this, and the other was the subject that pundits and presidents seem to especially enjoy. They like to pummel the bureaucracy and remind us that the good ideas almost never come from the bureaucracy. And that's relevant to our speaker because for 30 years he served in four different agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of State, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the Congressional Research Service and the Library of Congress. He reached the pinnacle of his career in 1999 when he was named National Intelligence Officer for East Asia in the National Intelligence Council. So he's had a good look at what the bureaucracy has had to offer, what it has had accepted. I thought of that when Tony Lake, in our Carter oral history effort, said that the single greatest problem of the Carter administration was that the president had failed to drive his policy down into the depths of the bureaucracy and receive responses from the bureaucracy in turn. And one can't help comparing that with some of the things one learns in a university like Virginia. Just one example, President Frank Herford used to say that Vice President Vincent Shea, the hero of several of us, saved him from more mistakes than any collection of people in the whole university by advice and counsel. So negatively and positively, those who serve in government have a role to play, and very often they play it. Because this is early in the new administration, and because Bob Sutter would like to speak very frankly about this new administration and some of the problems that arise. This session will be off the record, but we will make available a summary for anybody who wants it after the discussion. But those two subjects, in a way, epitomize the offering that we're likely to have this morning. Great knowledge on East Asia, Harvard PhD, 11 books, all through the time when he was carrying heavy responsibility. A wife who earned her PhD not too many years after he did at the University of Virginia in the government and education departments, and a family who continue his tradition in one way or another. So we're very pleased to welcome him once again to speak at the Miller Center on a subject of great concern to all of us, U.S.-China relations.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here, if only to get an introduction like that. It's really, thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure to be here. Dr. Thompson is a big fixture in our family. As he mentioned, my wife Valerie got her PhD here at the University of Virginia. My daughter Karen, who is a specialist on China with the U.S.-China Business Council, is a graduate of the university and a graduate of Dr. Thompson's. My son John is in medical school. He went to the University of Virginia too, but he didn't take foreign affairs, at least in Asian affairs. But we go way back and have deep roots here, and we're very happy to be here. I'm very happy to be here again. The topic I'm talking about, and I appreciate doing this off the record, I mean, goodness, just I can't go and talk to the policymakers and say, gee, I just gave a speech on illusions in American-China policy. It's really hard for me to do that, so if we can keep it off the record, I'd certainly appreciate it. But there are illusions. And they're quite, the story I guess I'm going to lay out today is what are these illusions, but why do we have them? You know, why and why do they persist? And my message isn't really a happy one, because I think they will persist. I think the complexity of the debate in the United States over China policy is such, and the motives and the drivers behind that debate are so strong, that this will persist. We're not going to end this quickly. And so what I'd like to do is try to explain why this happens, because I think what we have to do as American citizens is to have some, those of us that are American citizens, we need to have some sort of a sense of the complexity of China. We need to look at it in a sophisticated way. And I think it's very easy not to do that. I think we get easily caught up in various ways of looking at China, which are illusions and are problems in the formulation of a fair policy. So my appeal today is an appeal for understanding the complexity of China. I guess it boils down to balance. Be comprehensive and balanced in how you think about China. And if you're comprehensive and balanced, I think you'll avoid the illusions and you'll have a more reasonable approach in dealing with a country as complicated as China. So for today, and if we have time, of course, I will go on. I will make some points about the new administration as opposed to the previous administration, but that can always come up in question and answers as well. So the question is, what are these illusions? Why do we have them? And are we likely to get more realistic or not in our views of China? Well, let's take a look at some of these examples of these illusions. You know, China is an number one. China is an oppressive and authoritarian state. Well, you know, that's true in a lot of ways. Politically, it's very authoritarian and very oppressive. But it ignores lots of aspects of Chinese life and the society and economics and so forth, which is very free and very open and widely expanding. A second illusion, China is a threat. Those of you that saw the paper, the Washington Post this morning, the Chinese defense budget is going up, what, 17% is what they said? This is serious stuff. So is China a threat to Taiwan? Yes, it is. To Eastern Asia and surrounding areas? Sort of. To the United States? Somewhat, particularly in the Taiwan contingency. To areas further than that, like the Panama Canal? No, it's not a threat to the Panama Canal. But the question is, people talk about China as a threat, and they look at developments in China, and they see the strength of the Chinese economy, they see the strength of the Chinese military, but they ignore lots of weaknesses in China. And the greatest weakness in China is probably their political system and how brittle it is. And so you find that the Chinese leadership, even when challenged in major ways, the former president of Taiwan, Li Donghui, challenged them in a major way in 1999. They were challenged by the Kosovo air campaign, which led to the bombing of their embassy. That was quite a challenge to them. And yet the Chinese had to decide what to do about this. Were they ready to confront the West? Were they ready to confront the United States? Hardly. They came back and dealt with the United States in a pragmatic way, and they came back and are trying to deal with Taiwan in a more or less pragmatic way. A third illusion that we have is that China is changing rapidly, and it's moving toward greater interdependence and greater and moving toward greater pluralism and ultimately democracy. And yes, China is changing economically, and yes, they are moving. They are more economically interdependent. And yet this greater strength can lead to greater force and greater assertiveness. You'd be naive to ignore the linkage between their economy and their military capabilities and their goals. And their goals are fairly strong in many cases. Economic change leads to social change, leads to political change, argue many social scientists. And this will lead to greater moderation in Chinese behavior. And I tend to agree with this, but I also agree this is going to take a very long time if you let this play out. Let's look at Taiwan. In the case of Taiwan, they underwent this kind of change. It took them over 40 years to do this. China is much bigger, has many more problems. Perhaps this will take much longer. And those that are skeptical of this can also point to countries that have modern economies and undergo various changes but don't moderate politically. Nazi Germany is a good example of that. And another myth, another illusion, is that we have this economic change will make China a bonanza for U.S. economic interest. And of course, we have this massive trade deficit with China. Actually, it is a bonanza for some companies in the United States, but it's much more complicated than that. We still sell a lot more to Taiwan than we do to mainland China as a country. So the question I really like to focus on, though, is why do we have these illusions and why are they important? Illusions about China are not new. Any of us that have studied the history of American relations with China know that. There's a long history of these kinds of illusions, and yet we found that in the period from 1970 to around up to 1990, we really didn't have that many illusions that drove our policy toward China. That was a period of great strategic need for China. This was sort of the Nixon administration made the opening to China, and the strategic rationale of that opening persisted up until the 1990s. But after the 1990s, we find that that our debate over China policy has become more active. And the debate over China policy is driven by a lot of different factors, and the illusions are used in this debate in various ways. And so, while prior to 1989 and 1990, we had a strategic need for China against the Soviet Union, and that was widely accepted in the United States. And we also didn't debate too much about China because we had a sense of progress in China, that China was moving, seemed to be moving in the right direction toward norms favored by the United States. But since 1989 and 1990, U.S.-China policy has been subject to great debate. And there are two basic reasons for this. First, the end of the Cold War. And with the end of the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy as a whole has been subject to great debate. We've lost our strategic direction. We're much more focused on domestic concerns. And there are many competing interests that come into play in American foreign policy in this environment. And we have no consensus about our foreign policy, except that we want it to cost less and give us more benefit. But apart from that, we really don't have much of a consensus. I mean, there are those, for example, who say there are important American interests overseas, but the United States over time is not as powerful as it used to be, and therefore needs to accommodate other power centers in the world in order to preserve those interests. And George Bush Sr. was a good example of that kind of thinking. And this would involve a relatively accommodating posture toward China. Others felt that the United States, maybe it is somewhat weaker than it was in the past, but the reason for that is because it's being drained by these various foreign engagements. And therefore, the United States needs to pull back, to come home. You don't see this argument too much recently, but as the economic situation in the United States turns down, these kind of thinking tends to rise. And Ross Perot, I think, is the best example of this kind of thinking. And then you have a third view, which is not very very coherent. I mean, it isn't well organized, but a lot of Americans think this way. They basically think that we have important interests overseas, and that while it looks like we're somewhat, over time, getting a little weaker than we used to be, actually we're stronger than ever. And that this is our opportunity to push the American agenda on the world. Now, this sounds very hegemonic, and most Americans don't think of themselves as hegemonic. But in fact, when they get into special cases, they really do feel this way, whether it's human rights, environmental issues, trade issues, against proliferation, against war crimes, this type of thing. They become extremely interventionist on these particular cases. Kosovo is an example of this. But the point I'm making is that there's really no coherence in this policy. There's a lot of debate in our country about foreign policy, and China policy is no exception. At the same time, looking at China, after the Tiananmen incident, the argument that China was moving in the right direction was subject to great challenge. It was now seen that China was not conforming to international norms. And so you put these two factors together, this domestic debate in the United States over foreign policy and this new view of China. You put these two things together, and you get a very complicated debate over China policy. Now, on China itself, I think the debate is Americans agree that we want China to conform to the norms we support, but we disagree on how to get China to do it. Some Americans say we have to engage China, and they portray China as changing, becoming more moderate and becoming more interdependent. And yet, as we've seen, China doesn't want to change in important areas to the United States. They don't want to change their political system. They think their human rights policy is basically appropriate. They think their stance on Tibet is appropriate. Well, Americans don't, in general. They're on Taiwan. We have big differences with China over Taiwan. On East Asian influence, the Chinese want to be more influential in East Asia, and the United States and its allies are in the way. This is a problem. On global leadership, the Chinese have a different view on global leadership than we do. They don't like the dominant role the United States plays in the world. And so those that want to engage China have some complications to deal with, but they still persist in this type of an engagement approach. Now, on the other side are those who feel you really can't trust this communist system in China. These Americans feel that you have to sort of bring down this system first before you can have a meaningful relationship with China. And here in the Congress, people like Jesse Helms is a good example of this kind of thinking. Now, in our country, most Americans, I find, go case by case. They're not wedded to one approach or another. They say, well, on this issue, we can cooperate with China. On that issue, we have to oppose China. So our approach tends to boil down to case by case, but each time we do it, we have to debate, come to an understanding, and move forward. Now, in this debate that we have in the United States over China policy, a couple of things are important to keep in mind. In general, Americans don't want conflict with China. We don't want to go to war with China in any serious way. So that puts a break on the debate. We may disagree with China on a whole range of issues, but very few Americans advocate wanting to have a conflict with China. And you know something? A lot of Americans don't want to miss out on the advantages they get from China. This is seen in the congressional debates on normal trade relations with China, because here, they debate over this issue in the Congress. They're very hot and heavy over the issues. But in general, they want the economic relationship with China to continue to go forward. They don't want that to stop. And so they don't want then serious retrogression in our relations with China. So you have this debate. You have these competing views in the United States over how to deal with China, but nobody seems to want it to go too far as confrontation is concerned or losing American economic advantage in dealing with China. Now, why do we have this debate? I mean, there are a lot of countries in the world that we have these differences with. Why do we have this debate in China, and why does it persist for so long? I gave you reasons as to why the debate began with the end of the Soviet Union and the Tiananmen incident, but that was over 10 years ago. But this debate continues. It's very hot and heavy. Well, on the one hand, it has to do with Chinese behavior. Chinese do things that are against American-backed norms and American what we want. But the other side has to do with American interest groups. And this is us. And actually, if you look at American policy toward China, it's heavily driven by this in various ways. There are particular interests in the United States, and many of you probably belong to some of the other or another of these groups, who are very sincere. They want better human rights, for example. They want fairer economic and trade relations with countries like China. They support Taiwan and its separate status from mainland China. They feel very strongly about Tibet. They don't like proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and China does it. And they see China as a national security danger, building up its military in a way that could be threatening to its neighbors and ultimately to the United States. So for all these kinds of reasons, they feel they should oppose China in one way or another. And so they feed into this debate. These are very sincere interest. There are those who are not, quote, so sincere. I come from Washington. I guess there are people there who are not always sincere. And they have other interests in mind. And one of those interests has to do with partisanship. And this is where we have to stay off the record a little bit. But this is an issue of great utility between and among the parties and within the parties. Now, how does this work? Well, the party in power, let's take the previous administration, the Clinton administration, it was engaging China. It had decided on a policy of engagement. Well, people wanted to go, its opponents wanted to go after them in one way or another. How could they do this? Well, they talk about China. And they say, you're too close to China, you're naive about China, and they would attack them in various ways. Did these people care about China? Sometimes they did. But often they just cared about tearing down the Clinton administration. That was their motive. But it was worse than that, because it was within the parties. You found that certain groups in the Republican Party didn't like that their leadership was not paying attention to their agenda within the Republican Party. And so they would attack their leadership for being too soft on economic engagement with China, which the leadership of the Republican Party wanted to continue. And so they would attack them, not so much to change their China policy, but to get them to pay more attention to their agenda. The same thing held true in the Democratic Party. People would attack Mr. Gore for being too soft on China in various ways, and they tended to represent constituencies, and this, I would say, labor was a big factor here, that wanted more attention from the Democratic Party for their interests. Did they care about China? I'm sure a lot of them did, but a lot of them wanted the Democratic leadership to pay more attention to their domestic constituencies. So partisanship is a big feature of this situation. Another feature is fundraising. If you're concerned about human rights in Burma, well, you can get some money you can raise money by talking about human rights in Burma, but you can raise a lot more money by talking about human rights in China. And so fundraising is very helpful. If your interest is to raise funds for your organization, you can focus on China and help yourself to a considerable degree. Of course, businesses are often concerned about their own business and not concerned about national economic interest. And then the area that I'm in now, national security. China's wonderful for national security. I mean, if you want to keep the defense budget high, you have to have something to talk about. And China's a big thing to talk about. You can spend lots of dough getting together, figuring out what you're going to do about China. Now, I think you need to take China seriously, but there are those that have motives in this regard that are not necessarily just national security. They're looking for something that's more important. They're looking for a driver for American security interests. And China's getting itself right into the crosshairs in recent years. The background of all this is that this can persist because U.S. opinion on China is mixed, and because the U.S. media continues to focus on China and focus on negative features of China. So in this type of situation, what is the outlook? What's going to happen with this debate? The debate continues. There's really no sense that this debate is going to attenuate in the short term. What about the longer term? Well, let's take a look at it. This is an equation. You have to look at what China's going to do, and you have to look at what we're going to do. Let's look at what China's going to do. Now, China wants to get along with us. They need, and we can get in on the question and answer period, we can get into the reasons why that China needs to keep on good terms and have a good working relationship with the United States over the next several years at least. But they will remain politically authoritarian. And so they will crack down on any organized political party. They will crack down on the Falun Gong. They will crack down on religious dissidents. All sorts of groups. So in this sense, they're going to do things that will offend many Americans. Economically, the Chinese will try to resist some of the forces of globalization. And so this will cause issues. WTO compliance. China's joining the WTO. They will try, nonetheless, to resist some of these things in ways that will cause some difficulty for the United States. More salient, I think, are sovereignty issues like Taiwan and Tibet. Beijing is really focused on Taiwan, very key area. And this is an area where the United States has very important interest on the other side of the equation. And so we see them trying to, basically, they're building up their military forces to intimidate Taiwan and to keep us away from the fray, to intimidate us. And so this is quite a serious challenge from the American point of view. And their policy toward Tibet will continue in ways that will offend many Americans. Their standards of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction will continue to be a problem for most Americans. And their overall military modernization will be viewed with suspicion by many in the United States. Now, on the U.S. side, the debate will continue, I think, but first we will want engagement with China. Economically, we get lots of advantages overall from our interaction with China. We will want to avoid conflict, and so you have to engage with them in order to avoid conflict. We want to manage various issues. Korea is a good example. We have to communicate with China, have good relations with China over this issue to avoid missteps that would lead to a dangerous situation in Korea. And we are making progress with the Chinese on various issues. On proliferation, I think a lot of progress has been made in the U.S. Interaction with China. China doesn't proliferate nearly as much now if you compared it to, say, 10 years ago. So there are areas of great forward movement in our relationship with China. And yet, there will be plenty to criticize because the Chinese do not conform to U.S.-backed norms, human rights, sovereignty issues, economics, security questions, and so forth. And there'll be plenty of media attention to this. The media in our country persists in focusing on the negatives in dealing with China. This is something, I think it's underlying this, is the ambivalence of American attitudes toward China. In other words, Americans will read this stuff. They will watch it on television if you publish it. And so this has persisted. It's been over 10 years now since the Tiananmen incident, and yet this kind of approach by the media is persistent. So the outlook of this situation is that we will have continued debate in the United States over China policy. The motivation for this debate in the United States will come heavily from domestic forces inside the United States. And these domestic forces, I believe, will use illusions about China to substantiate their position in the debate, whether it has to do with the benefits of the relationship with China or it has to do with the negative features of the Chinese government and their policies. They will do this in order to back their position in the debate. As Americans persist in being the dominant power, I think those that want to pursue an American agenda in the world will become stronger, have become stronger in recent years, that third group I talked about earlier. And those people seem to have less tolerance toward countries like China and their behavior. And so they can tend to be more anxious to push their agenda. And so my sense is this is going to lead to even perhaps more friction in our relationship with China. Under these circumstances, it's going to be very hard to pursue the complexity of China and to understand it, and to preserve a balanced policy toward the PRC and avoid the extremes in our relationship with China. It seems to me for this to change, we would need some sort of a large crisis in order to stop the U.S. domestic preoccupation with China. And I think this is unlikely to happen. In other words, we did have a brief episode like this during the Persian Gulf War. We found that the United States very much needed China's help in that situation for the UN sanctions, for the UN blessing for the United States going in to drive out the Iraqis when they invaded Kuwait. And in that period, we had about 4 months in that period where there was no criticism of China by U.S. political leaders. It just stopped, because we needed China very much at that time. So the question is, will we get another time like that where we will stop allowing all these domestic forces to drive our policy and look out and say, China's important to us and we need it now, so would you domestic forces be quiet now while we deal with this thing? I just don't see that happening in the near term. So the bottom line is not terribly gloomy, because I think we will want to avoid conflict with China. We will persist in doing that. We will seek to preserve the economically advantageous relationship with China. The normal trade relationship that we have with China, that we call it, we will want to preserve that. But the debate will continue, and so will the illusions. And the imperative for a more reasoned and balanced view of China in the United States will probably remain low. So that's where I think we are, and that's where I think we're going. Now, I do have, do you want a couple of minutes on the new administration versus the older administration? If that's helpful to you, I'm pretty happy with the new people because they know an awful lot about Asia. These are really a very experienced crew that is coming in. Now, let me just give you a few examples. I mean, I don't want to say bad things about the previous administration, because I had a good working relationship with them as well. But they were working, I found at the assistant secretary level and the director of the at the White House staff dealing with these issues, and at the deputy assistant secretary level at the Pentagon, these folks in the previous administration were quite strong on Asia. But when you got above that, it was very difficult to find people that understood East Asia or were concerned about East Asia in a primary way. I never thought Madeleine Albright really liked to go to China. She just didn't like it. I mean, she can't use her French, she can't use her Russian, you know, this kind of stuff. She just isn't into that. And really, people make a difference. And then Strobe Talbot, you know, he was focused on Russia. He was number two in the State Department, and he was focused on Russia. And so that was their focus. And then the Pentagon people. Now, Cohen did have an interest in East Asia. He was pretty good at this. But Sandy Berger wanted to make sure China policy didn't blow up. He was very concerned about that. But these folks at the deputy level, in particular, are very strong. I mean, Paul Wolfowitz, former Assistant Secretary for East Asian Affairs, ambassador to Indonesia, very knowledgeable person on East Asia. And Richard Armitage, a very senior person, worked on East Asia in the Reagan and Bush years. He's the number two in the State Department. So you get these two people, and then you look just below them in the people they're bringing in for the White House staff, the people they're bringing in for the Assistant Secretary slot. These are people, the person in the Assistant Secretary of East Asia served as the senior White House person dealing with East Asia in the Reagan-Bush years. And then he stayed in the, been experiencing this ever since. These are sort of a team. They're very much a team, and they very much know East Asia. And so they tend to look at things in a little different way than the previous group. As far as China is concerned, of course, there are lots of continuities. Engagement will continue. We will not want to go backward in our relationship with China. We will have the same types of interests with China. I think the issues where they'll probably be a little firmer with China have to do with, of course, they are very committed to national missile defense. And this is something that's obviously a difference with the Chinese government. So this is a difference in the administration. And we have to wait to see, but their approach toward Taiwan and arms sales to Taiwan, there'll be some decisions made in April. They're probably leaning toward a type of approach to Taiwan that will be possibly less deferential to the PRC in that regard. But I think the thing that's different is the style of the new team. And this has to be played out over time, but I think they're much more deliberative. They're much less going off with a few people moving together and pushing an agenda or a new initiative someplace. It'll be much more, let's talk it over, let's decide, then move to the next step type of deliberation. And I think here the White House lead, clearly in the previous administration, the White House, after 1995-96, the crisis in the Taiwan Strait, the White House ran China policy. And basically they were making very sure there would be no wide swings in the relationship with China. And by wide swings, they didn't want another repeat of the 1995-1996 crisis in the Taiwan Strait. That was a very important feature. So the National Security Advisor was very, and his staff were very focused on this, and they did very much control the policy. I think that's changed now. I'm not sure who's taking the lead, but I think the State Department thinks they are. And we have to wait to see on that, because I have a sense that they probably will be. Unless the White House will be leading in that regard. And as they move it forward, it'll be more deliberative. You'll have more people get access. You won't have these secret groups working together to push the agenda forward in one direction or another. It'll be very much, you'll have a formal process that people will go through. It's sort of military. It's like a general, how a general would run his corps. And there are lots of generals and admirals, and if you look at all these senior people I mentioned, Armitage and Kelly and Patterson, they're all Navy officers, you see, so it's that kind of a style. The priorities will change. China will change in priority a little bit in this administration. Basically, it's going to have a lower priority. And you see this in small ways right now. But basically, who has President Bush called? All the world leaders congratulate him, and he calls up a few. But he hasn't called up the Chinese. He calls up the allies in East Asia. Allies matter to this group. So, and then who comes to the United States? Well, obviously the South Korean leader's coming tomorrow. And now, they wanted the Japanese leader to come first, but if you've been following Japan, it's really in rough shape. But I think he's still gonna come. I think he's still gonna come. And he will come probably before the senior Chinese leader comes. And this will be there for everybody to see. Now, this guy in Japan, Mr. Mori, is in big trouble, as we all know. If you ever thought about a lame duck, this guy is really a lame duck. I mean, you never know from one day to the next if he's going to be in power, and we all know he's going to be out of power within a month or two. And yet he's still coming. If he comes, and you have to wait and see what happens, but if he comes, he'll probably come before Chen Shih-chun, the senior Chinese vice premier, comes for his visit. And I think this is designed to just say Japan is seen as an ally. We have bases in Japan. We have troops in Japan. This is an important country for us. And so it's now China. Yeah, China's an important country. Thank you very much. Next question. You see, I think it's sort of that approach. And those of you that are interested in this in history, there's the team of Wolfowitz and Armitage ran China along with a fellow now deceased, Gaston Seeger, at the he was at the NSC, ran China policy under George Shultz. And I've heard them, Wolfowitz in particular, talk in terms of this is sort of a good period, a good model, how to deal with China policy. So if you're interested in it, I just go back and read it. It really does tell you a lot of how they're going to carry it out now. And basically, at that time, they sort of lowered the profile of China, the importance of China, and tried to raise up the importance of allies in East Asia, and particularly Japan. another feature, I think, is the previous administration, I think, had a great faith in globalization, had great faith in engagement. And so if you just You had great faith in the course of history. And so tactically, you didn't have to worry so much about different interactions because you were on the right side of history, and as President Clinton told Jiang Zemin, Jiang, on this issue, you were on the wrong side of history. And so you had a certain amount of faith in this regard. These folks, I think, are much more calculating, much more trying to figure out what our levers are and how we, when they go in to make key decisions on key issues, how much leverage do we have? And they'll try to maximize their leverage in the process. Those are just some of the features that I've seen, and of course there'll be many more that will show forth, and this is strictly just one person's view. But I do think that all of this may have some effect on our debate. I think it does. If you have a mature group that's widely experienced, and particularly on the national security side, is well respected, then I think a lot of the arguments that exaggerate the China threat can be put into context. Mr. Powell was asked at one of his early testimony before the Congress, he was asked about China's threat to the Panama Canal. And he basically said, well, we've looked into that and there's nothing to it. Next question, you see. And so, and I think people will accept that coming from Colin Powell. They might not accept it from someone, a civilian in the previous administration. So anyway, I don't think it's going to fundamentally change the debate, though. I think the debate, for the reasons I've mentioned and the entrenched domestic interests that focus on this debate, both for sincere interest and for not so sincere interest, I think this debate will persist. I'll stop there.
Who would like to begin the discussion? Yes, Charles Herbert.
I want to make a comparison. If you went to the Soviet Union in 1974, you would find exactly what we know about over here. we found that China would ship very friendly, amiable, hotels were good, US-type hotel. There weren't any guards at the end of the doorway or whatever. Is that a good observation, or does it fit in with the way you think now?
Do you want to repeat the question?
Yeah, the question had to do with the sort of the style and the way the Chinese versus the Soviets dealt with Americans. Yeah, the attitude of the Chinese. And now, it depends on what capacity you're in, I think. I mean, if you're going over there as a business person or a tourist or a scholar, things like that, sure, it's a very open place, lots of ways. If you're going over there as an official in some way, or you have an agenda that they're suspicious of, they'll be all over you in a very discreet way. They'll be plain clothes police. It won't be armed guards, but they'll control your. They'll try to control your atmosphere and your environment. So I guess the point I would make is that Soviet Russia was crude in the way it went about these things. The Chinese are very selective in what they're looking at, and what they're worried about as disruptive elements. And so most of the society, most of the things that foreigners do in China, doesn't matter, fine, go ahead and do it, no problem. But if you're in an area that's sensitive to them, and politics is a very sensitive area, if you wanted to organize labor in China, if you wanted to help Tibetans in some way, if you wanted, now if you got anywhere near the Falun Gong in this capacity, it would be a very different reaction. And they would, now, would they have a lot of guards on the floor of the hotel? No, of course not. It would be more sophisticated, but they would be watching you very carefully. And if they felt that you were in an area that was dangerous to them. So it's much more targeted, I guess, is what I would say.
Next question. Yes, Don Eckerlein.
Could you describe a little bit more fully what are both the centripetal and centrifugal forces within Chinese politics today? If we were looking at this 10 years from now, crystal ball, mm-hmm. would you say that China will be more unified, less so, mm-hmm. and for what reason?
That's a very good question. One of my jobs is to do national intelligence estimates, and that is we just estimate what's going to happen on key issues. And at the same time, we do conferences. So I'll have a big conference on an issue to examine it, to find out what business people, NGO reps, scholars, and others think about the same issue, so that we can sort of make sure that we in the government have the benefit of this expertise, because there's an awful lot of expertise about China. We're very rich on China in this country. Anyway, I had one of these meetings, and I started it off. There might have been 30 people, very expert people at this meeting. I started off and said, okay, we're looking at 5 years. Will this regime still be there in China 5 years? Big debate. They weren't sure. They said, I've never seen it so bad, very brittle, lots of problems. So 10 years, if you got the experts together, you could have a very, now ultimately that group agreed that they probably would sustain themselves, that the regime would persist, it would be weaker and more challenged. And this is, to me, this is the big drag on China as a great power. It's this system that they have, the ability of the regime to sustain their power. And because they want to, and they want to sustain a monopoly of power, and yet it's challenged by all the different economic and social and other forces that many talk about over time. And on top of that comes the new challenges of state-owned enterprise reform. It's a big issue for them. They're carrying it out. The issues of economic globalization more broadly, WTO compliance, and the effect that's going to have, and then the information revolution. Put all that together, and they're busy trying to stay in power. And so, and then over the next year or two, they have a big succession in their leadership. More than half of the very senior leaders have to retire, and they'll have a new leadership in 2002. And then there's always Taiwan, and then there's us. with national missile defense, doing things that just drive them crazy. And so you put all this together, and it's a very complicated mix. And it's a system that's trying to stay in control against the odds haven't been looked too good lately. You know, I mean, systems like that don't last real well. They're challenged all the time. So that's why I'm getting back to the point. I think this is a big weakness for China, this system that they have. I think China would be a much more powerful and formidable country if they didn't have their leaders worrying about having to put down political dissidents or Falun Gong worshippers or things like that. But they're spending so much time doing that that they really can't focus as much on traditional wealth and power like development.
Next question. Yes.
Do Chinese have any allies or supporters? And if they do, how do they affect their thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Do Chinese have any allies and supporters? And if they do, how does that affect their thinking?
The Chinese, in theory and mainly in practice, carry out an independent foreign policy. So they don't like to get too close to anybody. But in the current situation, they find that there are countries that they cooperate with on a lot of different issues. Very broadly, they try to cooperate with the third world. They feel that they can represent third world interests, work with third world countries in the UN and other places. This is heavily political. The importance of this is political. It's posturing. It doesn't have a lot of substantive concern. Around their periphery, they try to keep on good relations with all the countries around their periphery. And they have close relations over time with countries like Pakistan. Pakistan's remained a loyal a friend of China for its own reasons, obviously, but they've been very close since, 30, 40 years now between the Chinese. And it's interesting, China doesn't have any friend, though, that it can really point to as an ally. The United States has allies. You know, we get into trouble, there are certain people we can call on. We can say, you know, the British are there, the Australians are usually there, and several of the NATO people. The French are almost there sometimes, you know. I mean, there are people you can call on. The Israelis are there, and China doesn't have that. They don't have that at all. But they do have countries they cooperate with, and they're trying to build a closer relationship with a lot of them. And the main one that you have to worry about, that I have to worry about, is Russia. Because the Chinese are trying to build a strategic partnership with Russia. Now, this has a couple of dimensions. The political dimension is driven by what we do and how they react to it. So Kosovo, Chechnya, Taiwan, all this drives the Chinese and the Russians together politically to condemn us and to work against us in the UN and other places. That's important, but it's not that important. Where it's really important are arms sales and military cooperation. And here the Russians are transferring lots of arms to China. Now this isn't really an alliance, this is really a marriage of convenience. The Chinese want those weapons because they have to modernize their military to intimidate Taiwan and to push us away from the Taiwan contingency over time. And the Russians need to sell weapons. And so you put that together, that's been going on for 10 years, but it seems to have been increasing a little bit over the last year or so. So that's where it matters. We're an ally. It's not an ally, but but they have a close relationship. And politically, they're close because of they don't like U.S., what they call U.S. hegemony. But getting back to their priorities, what are their priorities? Their priorities are to stay in power. And to do that, they have to modernize their economy to satisfy the needs of their people. That comes first. Opposing hegemony is important, but unless it intrudes on them, like Taiwan declares independence, the United States occupies Taiwan, does something egregious against China, that's not coming first. What comes first is staying in power, economic development, to sustain the party in power. That's what's first.
Mr. Williams?
Could you comment on the creativity and the success that the Chinese government has or doesn't have in dealing with, in two areas, dealing with Hong Kong and dealing with economic free enterprise zones, new experiments, a decade ago.
Right.
You don't hear much about it, but there must be pressures to expand that.
Sure.
And is the government managing the creativity that you need to manage the special considerations of Hong Kong and the free economic?
I think they've done a good job in both these areas, basically. A lot better job than many people would have thought 10 years ago. I think the, I mean, the Chinese are really an engine of growth in East Asia and in the world. They are conforming to these WTO norms. There will be many issues with their conformity, but they are doing it. And their leadership, they have a good team, good economic team headed by the Premier Zhu Rongji. He understands how conforming to world norms in economics benefits China. And so I think they're really doing a good job in this. As far as Hong Kong is concerned, I think they manage Hong Kong fairly effectively as far as economics is concerned. They have some political issues with Hong Kong, but not many. They've basically kept hands off. There are some intrusions, but not big ones. Hong Kong is suffering a bit. It's doing better now, but it has been suffering for a number of years. And it's hard to see what role it's going to play in the future. You know, as Shanghai develops, the Chinese will do this itself. It was sort of a node of for interaction with China, and it's still extremely important for South China. But China itself is now Pudong and Shanghai, and those places have developed so much that the ability of Hong Kong to keep up with that is going to be difficult. And if you're interested in a more stable, foreign-oriented place, then you go to Singapore. You're probably not going to go to Hong Kong anymore because it isn't foreign. You know, it is China. And so so you have that. They're in a bit of an awkward spot, but that's not Beijing's fault in that sense. I think their policies have basically been, I think they've done what they said they were going to do within a few limits. I mean, Falun Gong, you know, they intrude. They say to Hong Kong, now you have to do something about Falun Gong. And so Hong Kong government sweats a little bit, and they say, do we allow the demonstrations or not? This kind of thing. And there have been a couple of other issues that have come up, showing that the political freedom of Hong Kong isn't as much as it might be. But their freedom is pretty good over the last 10 years. And the PRC has been, I think, pretty good in maintaining their commitments.
Yes.
You mentioned Korea very briefly in your remarks. Could you elaborate a bit on Beijing-Pyongyang relations and what that implies for the role of the United States on the peninsula?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's of course, Korea is a very uncertain area. I think if you take as... I can just summarize. We had a conference with a lot of experts about a week ago on what the outlook is for the Korean situation, because that's sort of the base that you have to look at. And over the next year, the view was, well, we don't know what North Korea is going to do, but basically we think this controlled engagement with the South and with other countries is going to continue. It's going to be sort of incremental. In other words, no dramatic change, but it's continued progress. And there was some concern that maybe the U.S. will be less forthcoming to the North, and that'll slow it down, and maybe South Korea will be a little less forthcoming because of domestic pressures in South Korea. This is important because, to answer your question, you have to have that sort of understanding. With that kind of understanding, China is very well positioned in dealing with Korea. China likes this gradual type of improvement on the Korean Peninsula. It eases tensions. China has excellent relations with South Korea, has good relations with North Korea, and it's able to keep that in balance. It doesn't. There's no going to be no dramatic change in the Korean Peninsula. That type of situation works very well for them, and so I think they're basically happy right now. They would worry if there was going to be a big switch in the situation, and particularly if there was some rapid move toward reunification that didn't include them. But they are now well positioned with the South, with the North, so they'll be included in some way or another. And I think they're much less concerned about that. And so for the next year or so, my sense is the Chinese are pretty content with the situation and not worried. they might have been a little worried if it looked as if the North Koreans were going to just tilt completely to the United States, have Bill Clinton come to North Korea, sign a deal, and change their system. But that looks very unlikely under the current circumstances, and probably was unlikely even then. So that would be a worry for China. And of course, a conflict would be a worry for China if there were a conflict on the peninsula. But I think those extremes are unlikely. So given the median ground here, I think that they're in pretty good shape.
Bob Myers is going to give a forum on Korea on the 28th of March. New book.
Yes, sir. Yes. For the Washington Post had an article recently, I think, that was on how China might develop in the next few years and how much of a threat it might be to the United States. Mm-hmm. It was talking about the military threat of China in general. It said it didn't have any infrastructure, didn't really have any mobile troops, didn't have any ships that were really worth worrying about. And so do you think that in the next 10 years it could actually be a military threat to the United States?
Well, this is something that I spend a lot of time trying to be balanced about. In my line of work, there are an awful lot of people that warn about China. And they tell you China's dangerous, this can happen, that can happen. It is dangerous, and I think it's dangerous mainly in a Taiwan contingency. And what the Chinese are doing is building up pretty steadily, and it may be increasing a little bit more, their ability to engage the United States in a Taiwan contingency. They don't want to do this. They have to keep the economy going. And they have to keep popular support. But someday, and this is the question, when will they be ready to do this? Someday they'll want to go to Taiwan and say, we've got you covered. Now you better come to terms. That seems to be their objective. And they know after 1995 and 1996, at least they plan, that the U.S. will be there. And so they've got to tell the U.S., and we're going to do this in Taiwan, and we don't want you to interfere. And if you do interfere, you're going to have to find a way to do it. And so the way we would do it, probably, would be from our bases in Japan, and then our forward-deployed carrier forces and this type of thing. And so what they're building, first they're building air defense. They saw Kosovo. They didn't like it. They thought what we were able to do with Serbia, and they said, we need air defense. So they're buying lots of air defense, and it's very good and in certain areas. And then they're building a capability to keep the U.S. further away. And so they're buying fighters, they're buying submarines, they're buying destroyers, and they're just getting more of them. And they're having, with longer range missiles, whether air-launched missiles or sea-launched missiles, that will make it costly for the United States to be close. And so the idea is then the aircraft carriers would have to stand off. Otherwise, they would run the risk. And when they stand off, they're less able to go in and do what they need to do to in a Taiwan contingency. That seems to be the plan. That's what they're doing. Now, that's, I just had lunch with my old friend, the Chinese Navy attaché, on Thursday, and I said, Captain Lee, he's senior Captain Lee. I said, Captain Lee, you know what you're doing? I said, we don't have any big threats anymore, and you keep doing this, and you're putting yourself right in the crosshairs of the American military-industrial complex. And so I think it's just a matter of time, and probably a short time, before the United States takes very serious countermeasures against this. And that'll involve lots of long-range munitions. It'll involve sensors to know where the Chinese submarines are. It'll involve a whole range of stuff so that if there is a conflict, we will know where their platforms are, and we will sink them. And we will do it quickly and before they can endanger us. And now that takes an awful lot of infrastructure to do that, very expensive. But I'm afraid that the Chinese, by persisting with this buildup, are basically giving the American defense establishment no other choice. So there, they're a threat, no question about it. And elsewhere, I don't see it, but I do see it in the Taiwan contingency.
Remember the questioner and the answer. The questioner is our best bet to someday be an admiral, and the speaker has spoken with great authority on the subject. And so this isn't a bunch of has-beens. These are all of us are thinking hard about these questions, and some are likely to have a considerable result one of these days. So remember that question and that answer as we close the meeting, and we want to thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you. Real pleasure.